was a guy named Eric Auerbach, and he was one of those German Jewish intellectual guys, kind of like Erasmus, who probably read everything there was to read and when he was around, and, you know, spoke 12 languages, probably 8 of them dead, was a professor of romance philology, that kind of stuff. And during the unpleasantness of the mid-century in German-speaking countries, he retreated to Istanbul, where he had some kind of gig doing something. And when he was there, he wrote a book called Mimesis, which even today, even in Pomo 2006, is probably considered the greatest book of literary criticism of the 20th century. And he would say, and other people have said, that part of why it was so good is he didn't have much to work from. He didn't have his normal books, he didn't have his colleagues, he didn't have journals, he had nothing. So I thought, kind of in the spirit of Eric Auerbach, I would kind of resort to my own foul rag and bone shop of the heart, as my homie Yeats calls it. So the images you will see tonight is just some junk I had lying around my own house. And my Mimesis means imitation, so I'm in good company, I think. There's a bunch of things I've been wanting to write about. One was what I was calling the Enlightened Cynic's Guide to Elder Care, or Homicidal Impulses Are Normal. The minute your elder ends up in the hospital, throw everything of value in the safe deposit box. Another one was a non-pornographic coffee table book on sex and technology. Porno karaoke, material science of dildos and vibrators. Another was something about Vietnam-era draft dodgers in this country. I've been thinking about them because I've been thinking about the former Soviet bloc and Eastern Europe and what happens when you kill generation after generation of the people who speak out and do good and have integrity and how that rots a culture. And how did that affect us all that our best to brightest went to Canada? But the story that haunts me, that desperately needs to be told, is, like any good story, a long story. And in a way, it's been with me for years and years, and it begins in childhood, where Freud said all good stories begin. And I guess, because I can't speak German, it's a Bildungsroman, a story of a young person coming of age. It starts off when I was in what we would now call middle school, during the years I spent at the local public school, between my progressive, hippie-trippy, Quaker-inflected early childhood education and my later rigorous preparation at a snotty girls' school. I was the representative from the fifth grade to the student council. We had our meetings on the stage of the auditorium, a place much like this, behind the curtain, and the guy, who was vice president of the school, he was a year ahead of me, I found to be so swoony, snacky, as they say. I would goggle at him across the seated circle of kids at our meetings. Years later, I ran into him again at an exchange at Thatcher, which is California's Andover. It is a place where every boy, at that point it was only boys, had a horse, and only the offspring of the powers that be were sent there. We started a tragic romance. It didn't make sense to anyone, not least of which to either of us. He was a jock, I was not. He would never introduce me to his parents because I was Jewish and they were high wasp. My mother remarked on his beautiful manners, even as they solely manifested themselves to her in his deportment when he picked me up at the front door. He was too much the gentleman to remark on the dual reeks of rage and pathology that even he could get a whiff of as he drove us away from that house of Usher. There really only can be great thwarted romance when there are boarding schools involved, because you can't see each other. You are condemned to writing each other letters, and there is so much longing, and your time together is so compressed. So we would do stuff like make out in the dry washes of the Arroyo Seco in Pasadena, or if I were visiting him in San Francisco, where his family had moved to the southern slope of Pacific Heights, we'd end up in the parking lot at Fort Point. I remember the tact of the park rangers. At 9:45 p.m., they would use a public address system to say, "Ladies and gentlemen, the park will be closing in 15 minutes. They never tapped on car windows, no matter how steamy. Or we'd be at the beaches of Point Reyes, McClure's Beach. I don't know how it is that teenage boys know the good deserted places to go make out, but he always did. It was a relationship that was extremely passionate, broke new ground for both of us, and ended very badly. It didn't reflect well on either one of us, though probably reflected worse on me, humiliatingly so. He had been sweeter, and I had taken it all harder. Agonizing. Afterwards, I didn't talk to my mother about it at all. But the one time I remember her touching me, much beyond the age of six, that didn't involve, say, a slap across the face, happened about a month after he dumped me. She came up to me in the necrous hallway of our horrible house, right after I'd just seen the movie, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. In it, there's a sort of introverted young woman who gets involved with a boy only slightly older than her, and it ends badly. And the young man is cast in the movie, looked a lot like the young man I'm talking about here. She said, "Oh, you poor thing," and she hugged me. One, I was horrified that she had such intimate knowledge of me, and two, I didn't want sympathy from her. This was an overshadowing relationship. He was basically a good kid. He came from San Francisco robber baron stock, but was not one of the major names you would recognize. And he was from the cadet branch, so didn't have as much money as other descendants did, but they still had enough to send him to Thatcher. And when he was at Thatcher, he was encouraged to make strategic friendships in this small elite school in Ojai, a beautiful redoubt in the Southern California coastal range, where masters of New Age religions, screenwriters, and proprietors of spas now routinely reside. He would talk to me about how uneasy he was with the pressures he felt from his parents, about who he was supposed to make friends with, as opposed to who he wanted to be friends with, and how conflicted he was about it all. As it happened, two boys he was friendly with were subjects of interest. There was a descendant of a family that owns a company famous throughout the world for creating things like waterworks and dams and mass transit systems and energy extraction and just about anything you can think of that has to do with the built environment and usually ends up getting conflated with the scary, bad political power. The other might be characterized as the offspring of California agribusiness. California agribusiness is integral to making California's economy the sixth largest in the world. It is the major user of water in the state and the major user of power, because the water to turn semi-desert to hydroponic farms of cotton and wheat has to be pumped from somewhere, usually the Sierra. My princeling was encouraged to become friends with the built environment guy and the agribusiness guy. Thought that he wasn't already friendly with these guys in his same year, but he didn't want to make friends on the basis of efficacy and future utility. Anyway, he and I parted company not well. About 5 years afterwards, we saw each other again. I had just moved to Berkeley and was living in a group house near Grizzly Peak. So through mutual friends, he and I arranged to go for a walk in the Rose Garden and just, you know, talk and only slightly shiver in the gray fall afternoon. Afterwards, without meaning to, I made him the worst cup of cocoa I have ever prepared for anyone in my entire life. Since I'd last seen him, he'd gone to UC Davis and gotten some sort of degree in ecology and was really into bicycling and doing that UC Davis thing, but he commented how he was really tired of living paycheck to paycheck. Still, he was living the 70s ecology-centered life, and I still felt about him at that point that this is fundamentally a decent human being, trying to live a good life on modest scale. There was still a strange chemistry between us, which scared the hell out of both of us because we sure as hell knew we didn't belong together. I didn't hear from him again, and I didn't even hear about him again. We both grew up and went on with our lives. I really lost track of him. Cut. In the middle of the dot-com boom, this was a really not-so-crazy time, particularly in the Bay Area, when it seemed like enemy invaders or Nazis or vampires had taken over. People you'd known for years had been replaced by pod people, and there were kinds of people in the Bay Area in numbers I'd never seen before. Marketing weasels and financial sharpies and the kinds of female communications majors that, if they are lucky, usually end up marrying pro football players. People were believing in the most ridiculous nonsense. It was also the era when, as a joke, I would make up the idea for a company and then it would come into existence. Eat gravel. I dry cleaning, dogfood.com. And then I'd think, no one could be stupid enough to fund those companies, and then they would materialize into existence. One twilight, I was driving from San Francisco to Berkeley, and I happened to see something painted on the walls of one of the financial district office buildings visible from the lower deck of the Bay Bridge, a spot where there is now painted one of those patriotic gore, red, white, and blue, yellow, ribbony exhortations.
United we stand.
You have to realize this was a time when billboards and cars and condoms were emblazoned with the names of the latest silly.com company. So I glanced over and saw painted on the side of that building an advertisement for something called utility.com. Now I thought, this wins the prize. This is the stupidest idea for a company I have ever heard of. Buying your electricity online? No, really bad. Electricity is a concrete thing in the real world. You shouldn't buy it online. Unlike what Nicholas Negroponte says, we live in a world of atoms and not bits. But I also have the sensation you read about in bad horror and suspense fiction that can only be described as someone walking across your grave. It gave me the chills. I didn't know why. Then came the dot-com crash, around the same time California was experimenting with energy deregulation. Unlike anyone else I know, I decided I wanted to go with clean power. So I signed up to pay more money for my electricity, knowing it was going to be coming from wind and solar, renewable and sustainably generated. PG&E had an unregulated subsidiary that was doing this, and then they sold it to another company I'd never heard of, and then that got sold to another company I'd never heard of at the time called Enron. So I used to get my energy bills from Enron. So there we were, California in the middle of its tech wreck, and then came California in the middle of its false energy famine. Enron was much in the news, originally slobbered over as the smartest people in the room, and latterly as the bully boy who was holding California energy hostage. And I thought, I see, Texas is exporting California's wealth. So, like everyone else here at the time, I was an anxious observer of our energy crisis, rolling brownouts and blackouts, and it was feeling like the end of the world. And finally, the bad news about Enron's corporate malfeasance began to come out. At the same time, because of the tech wreck, I became addicted to a website called fuckedcompany.com, reading it every day. Fucked Company was started by a very smart young man in New York, and it became a place where people would post about the inner workings of companies as those businesses were going down, not limited to dot-com companies, but focusing on them. The people that worked at these places, or who used to work at these places, would post what they'd seen or heard, report news of layoffs, managerial screw-ups and monstrosities, all the inside poop imaginable about customers and ex-customers and clients and contractors and consultants and lawyers. It was an amazing cultural repository, and the comments of the guy who ran it were wicked. It became one of those reputation economy marvels where if your company was talked about in Fuck Company, it affected your bottom line, or at least required you to do some damage control. I learned so much about how people can use the vehicle of business to do evil that it's helped me to manage my mother's money as she slips ever more slowly into dementia. I didn't wish anybody ill, but I'd always known the whole dot-com hysteria was foolishness, and I took a great deal of comfort, not schadenfreude, but comfort, in my inner stance of a kind of silent, I told you so, I told you so. And here are the details of how my I told you so were working out. So I'd log on to read Fuck Company every day. And then the day came when I saw utility.com listed on Fuck Company. Of course, energy was on all of our minds. Shivering in the damp dark we were, it was winter, because we weren't having any in California. Even then, years before all the incriminating evidence about Enron and all the other corrupt energy trading companies came out, I had a suspicion that there were bad games, foul play on the loose. It just couldn't be that all these power plants had to be taken offline for maintenance at a time when we didn't have any energy. So I was reading about utility.com, and people were saying various things about the incompetence of the management there. And then I saw the name of the CEO was my princeling. And I thought, oh no, he became head of a dot-com? Thanks to Google, I tried to reconstruct his history as much as I could. I saw he'd gotten some sort of master's degree in some sort of ecology, environment, biology, something. And then the dark forces took over. He'd gone off to Stanford to get his MBA. While I don't have infinite respect for people who get MBAs from Stanford, I'd also say Maya Princeling was not a brainiac. I remember he'd gotten held back a year after we met in middle school, me in fifth grade, him in sixth, so that we were in the same high school graduating class. Better for him to withstand the academic demands of Thatcher. So it was hard for me to imagine he got into Stanford entirely on the basis of his GMATs, but I could be wrong. From there, he went on to become something like Vice President of Public Affairs at PG&E. Then he went on to some very shady-looking energy and power-related businesses that seemed to have gone down in a lot of lawsuits and bad blood and managerial squabbling. But I hadn't heard about this at all in the years that all this had been going down, because I hadn't been paying attention to either energy policy or corporate governance, nor had I any reason to. So there I was reading about my princeling on Fuck Company. People were impugning his competence, his intelligence, his sexuality, his everything. The details of this didn't really matter to me, and I can't really know the truth of them. I was watching all this, and I was thinking, this is Chinatown. In California, it's all about water, and it's all about power. There wouldn't have been much of a Los Angeles where I was born unless Mulholland had constructed the pipeline to steal the water from the Owens Valley in the Eastern Sierra. Although that's had the unintended good effect of preserving that land ever since its watershed, thus protecting it from the development of ski-in, ski-out condos that get to adjoin golf courses in the summer. In the West, we are always squabbling over water, thank you, Mark Reiser. Without it, we would have nothing, and the Colorado River doesn't even flow to the sea anymore, and Phoenix lives on recycled water, the worst-tasting stuff you'd ever want to not drink. It's a resource of such scarcity that can't be imagined for people back east, where the drinking fountains called bubblers in Wisconsin parks run continuously as long as the temperature is above freezing, and Manhattanites have never paid for the water piped in from the Catskills. So I kept reading Fuck Company, watching utility.com go down, and saw that my princeling had also gotten involved in what used to be called a company incubator in Pasadena, another one of those enterprises that collapsed after taking tons of investor money. The people at the top, like my princeling, I guess, having looted it, the entity itself having done nothing useful, and it became the object of tons of lawsuits. So I was looking at all this and thinking about my princeling and thinking about his connection to the crown prince of the people who build dams and do electricity and his connection with the heir apparent of agribusiness, which is reliant on water and the energy to pump water more than anything else, or which makes vast amounts of money by selling the agricultural water rights to developers who want to build subdivisions. So I thought, well, I thought lots of things. I was wondering, as I had for a long time, how old money became new. Not the more usual concern about how the parvenu try to integrate themselves into society and how new money becomes old, usually by new money wealth marrying old money beauty, but about how the old power elite of California participated in the craziness of the late 90s. How did the existing financial structure participate in all that ridiculous speculation and profit from it? How did they get their prime, if notably hidden, share of what was basically the biggest transfer of wealth from the middle classes to the plutocracy that the world has ever seen? So I've been wondering this for a long time, and seeing the sketchy movements of my princeling, I was wondering how his relationships had been operating during this time period with these two guys, the masters of water and power. The conclusion I came to is that there is a novel in this, and that the reason it has to be a novel, even though it would require research, is that I have no idea if he kept up with his friends from Thatcher. And I can't possibly know what decisions over dinner at wonderful places to eat on the Sonoma coast created any of my princeling's bogus business dealings. But I can imagine them. And a novel would be a way to talk about how water and power are perennial issues in California. And really, these politics of water and power are the politics of the nation and the world. But more important to me is the more foundational issue of character and how it gets affected by money. My princeling was basically a good guy, but at least as I knew him, he wasn't courageous and he wasn't strong. How did his innocence get finally corrupted? How did he become this person I know in no way he wanted to be? He gave in to what his class background demanded he be. He was a fundamentally sweet man who had clearly been involved in corporate shenanigans for more than a decade. And that's the material for a novel, how character gets corrupted, how a good soul goes bad, and how people get caught up in the circumstances of their time. So here it is, 2006, and we watch the disasters that are Katrina and Rita, and more recently the floods in Napa, and everyone's PG&E bills have shot up this winter. And it's all about water, and it's all about power. There's a novel here. And until the MacArthur Foundation clears up its clerical error, I doubt I'll be able to write it.